Chapter 13. Brine. Fancy, not merely a diver, but a sardonic diver. And the expression of his confounded countenance on discovering, not only a pearl, but an eclipsed pearl, which was in a diseased oyster. I say it is only by an uncommon and happy combination of taste, genius, and industry, that a man can arrive at uttering such sentiments in such fine language, that such a man ought to be well paid, as I have no doubt he is, and that he is worthily employed to write literary articles, in large type, in the leading journal of Europe. Don't we want men of eminence and polite learning, to sit on the literary bench, and to direct the public opinion? But when this profound scholar compares me to a scavenger who leaves a copy of verses at his door, and begs for a Christmas box, I must again cry out and say, my dear sir, it is true your simile is offensive, but can you make it out? Are you not hasty in your figures and allusions? If I might give a hint, to so consummate a rhetorician, you should be more careful in making your figures figures, and your similes like. For instance, when you talk of a book quelling the tide of exhilaration incident to the inauguration of the new year, or of a book hearing the stamp of its origin in vacuity and sea, or of a man diving sardonically, or of a pearl eclipsed in the display of a diseased oyster, there are some people who will not apprehend your meaning. Some will doubt whether you had a meaning. Some even will question your great powers, and say, is this man to be a critic in a newspaper, which knows what English, and Latin too, and what sense and scholarship, are? I don't quarrel with you, I take for granted your wit and learning, your modesty and benevolence, but why scavenger Jupiter James, why scavenger? A gentleman, whose biography the Examiner was fond of quoting before it took its present serious and orthodox turn, was pursued by an outraged wife to the very last stage of his existence with an appeal almost as pathetic, ah, sir, why scavenger? How can I be like a dustman that rings for a Christmas box at your hall door? I never was there in my life. I never left at your door a copy of verses provocative of an annual gratuity, as your noble honor styles it. Who are you? If you are the man I take you to be, it must have been you who asked the publisher for my book, and not I who sent it in, and begged a gratuity of your worship. You abused me out of the Times window, but if ever your noble honor sent me a gratuity out of your own door, may I never drive another dust cart. Provocative of a gratuity. Oh, splendid swell! How much was it your worship sent out to me by the footman? Every farthing you have paid I will restore to your lordship, and I swear I shall not be a halfpenny the poorer. As before, and on similar seasons and occasions, I have compared myself to a person following a not dissimilar calling. Let me suppose now, for a minute, that I am a writer of a Christmas farce, who sits in the pit, and sees the performance of his own piece. There comes applause, hissing, yawning, laughter, as may be. But the loudest critic of all is our friend the cheap buck, who sits yonder, and makes his remarks, so that all the audience may hear. This a farce, says Bo Tips colon Demi. It's the work of a poor devil who writes for money, confound his vulgarity. This a farce. Why isn't it a tragedy, or a comedy, or an epic poem, stab my vitals? This a farce indeed. It's a feller as sends round his hat, and appeals to charity. Let's have our money back again, I say. And he swaggers off, and you find the fellow came with an author's order. But if, in spite of Tips, are in friends, and see if the little farce, which was meant to amuse Christmas, or what my classical friend calls Exodus, is asked for, even up to Twelfth Night, shall the publisher stop, because Tips is dissatisfied. Whenever that capitalist calls to get his money back, he may see a letter from the respected publisher, informing the author that all the copies are sold, and that there are demands for a new edition. Up with the curtain, then. Vivid Regina. And no money returned, except the Times gratuity. M.A. Titmarsh. January 5, 1851. The Kickleberries on the Rhine. The cabman, when he brought us to the wharf, and made his usual charge of 6 times his legal fare, before the settlement of which he pretended to refuse the privilege of annexiatory note to our luggage, glared like a disappointed fiend when Langan, calling up the faithful Hutchison, his clerk, who was in attendance, said to him, "Hutchison, you will pay this man. My name is Sergeant Langan, my chambers are in Pump Court. My clerk will settle with you, sir." The cabman trembled. We stepped on board. Our lightsome luggage was speedily whisked away by the crew. Our berths had been secured by the previous agency of Hutchison, and a couple of tickets, on which were written, "Mr. Sergeant Langan, Mr. Titmarsh, Langan's, by the way, incomparably the best and comfortablest sleeping place," were pinned onto two of the curtains of the beds in a side cabin when we descended. Who was on board? There were Jews, with Sunday papers and fruit. There were couriers and servants straggling about. There were those bearded foreign visitors of England, who always seemed to decline to shave or wash themselves on the day of a voyage, and, on the eve of quitting our country, appear inclined to carry away as much as possible of its soil on their hands and linen. There were parties already cozily established on deck under the awning, and steady-going travelers forward, smoking already the pleasant morning cigar, and watching the phenomena of departure. The bell rings. They leave off bawling, "Anybody else for the shore?" The last crape and bells life merchant has scuffled over the plank. The johns of the departing nobility and gentry line the brink of the quay, and touch their hats. Hutchison touches his hat to me, heaven bless him. I turn round inexpressibly affected and delighted, and whom do I see but Captain Hicks. "Hallo! You here?" says Hicks, in a tone which seems to mean, "Confound you, you are everywhere." Hicks is one of those young men who seem to be everywhere a great deal too often. How are they always getting leave from their regiments? If they are not wanted in this country,
as wanted they cannot be, for you see them sprawling over the railing in Rotten Row all day, and shaking their heels at every ball in town.
If they are not wanted in this country, I say, why the deuce are they not sent off to India, or to Demerara, or to Sierra Leone? By Jove, the farther the better, and I should wish a good unwholesome climate to try 'em, and make 'em hardy. Here is this Hicks, then Captain Launcelot Hicks, if you please, whose life is nothing but breakfast, smoking, riding school, billiards, mess, poking, billiards, and smoking again, and Doc Capo pulling down his mustaches, and going to take a tour after the immense labors of the season. How do you do, Captain Hicks? I say, here are you going?
Oh, I am going to the wine, says Hicks. Everybody goes to the wine.
The wine indeed. I dare say he can no more spell properly than he can speak.
Who is on board anybody?
I ask, with the air of a man of fashion. Oh, whom does that immense pile of luggage belong under charge of the lady's maid, the courier, and the British footman? A large white K is painted on all the boxes.
How the deuce should I know?
Says Hicks, looking, as I fancy, both red and angry, and strutting off with his great cavalry lurch and swagger. Whilst my friend the sergeant looks at him lost in admiration, and surveys his shining little boots, his chains and breloks, his whiskers and ambrosial mustaches, his gloves and other dandifications, with a pleased wonder, as the ladies of the Sultan's harem surveyed the great lady from Park Lane who paid them a visit, or the simple subjects of Montezuma looked at one of court's heavy dragoons. "That must be a marquis at least," whispers Langan, who consults me on points of society, and is pleased to have a great opinion of my experience. I burst out in a scornful laugh. "Hat! I say, he is a captain of dragoons, and his father an attorney in Bedford Row. The whiskers of a Rocherier, my good Langan, grow as long as the beard of a Plantagenet. It don't require much noble blood to learn the polka. If you were younger, Langan, we might go for a shilling a night, and dance every evening at M. Lawrence Casino, and skip about in a little time as well as that fellow.
Only we despise the kind of thing you know. Only we're too grave, and too steady, and too fat, whispers Lankin, with a laugh. Speak for yourself, you maypole, says one. If you can't dance yourself, people can dance round you, put a wreath of flowers upon your old pole, stick you up in a village green, and so make use of you. I should gladly be turned into anything so pleasant, Lankin answers. And so, at least, get a chance of seeing a pretty girl now and then. They don't show in Pump Court, or at the University Club, where I dine. You are a lucky fellow, Titmarsh, and go about in the world. As for me, I never, and the judge's wives, you rogue? I say, no man is satisfied. And the only reason I have to be angry with the captain yonder is, that, the other night, at Mrs. Perkins, being in conversation with a charming young creature who knows all my favorite passages in Tennyson, and takes a most delightful little line of opposition in the church controversy just as we were in the very closest, dearest, pleasantest part of the talk, comes up young Hotspur yonder, and whisks her away in a polka. What have you and I to do with polkas, Lankin? He took her down to supper. What have you and I to do with suppers? Our duty is to leave them alone, said the philosophical sergeant. And now about breakfast, shall we have some? And as he spoke, a savory little procession of stewards and stewards' boys, with drab tin dish covers, passed from the caboose, and descended the stairs to the cabin. The vessel had passed Greenwich by this time, and had worked its way out of the massed forest which guards the approaches of our city. The owners of those innumerable boxes, bags, oilskins, guitar cases, whereon the letter K was engraven, appeared to be three ladies, with a slim gentleman of 32 or 33, who was probably the husband of one of them. He had numberless shawls under his arm and guardianship. He had a strap full of Murray's handbooks and continental guides in his keeping, and a little collection of parasols and umbrellas, bound together, and to be carried in state before the chief of the party, like the lictor's fasces before the consul. The chief of the party was evidently the stout lady. One parasol being left free, she waved it about, and commanded the luggage and the menials to and fro. Oris, we will sit there, she exclaimed, pointing to a comfortable place on the deck. Horace went and placed the shawls and the guidebooks. Ursh, avez-vous compté les pages? Trente sept morceaux en tout? The German courier said, Aue, Milady, and bowed a rather sulky assent. Omen, you will see that Finch is comfortable, and send her to me. The gigantic Omen, a gentleman in an undress uniform, with very large and splendid armorial buttons, and with traces of the powder of the season still lingering in his hair, bows, and speeds upon my lady's errand. I recognize Hirsch, a well-known face upon the European high road, where he has traveled with many acquaintances. With whom is he making the tour now? Mr. Hirsch is acting as courier to Mr. and Mrs. Horace Millican. They have not been married many months, and they are traveling, Hirsch says, with a contraction of his bushy eyebrows, with Milady, Mrs. Millican's mama. And he, who is her ladyship? Hirsch's brow contracts in two deeper furrows. He is Milady Giggleberry, he says, Mr. Didmarsh. Perhaps you know her. He scowls round at her, as she calls out loudly, Hirsch, Hirsch, and obeys that summons. It is the great Lady Kickleberry of Pocklington Square, about whom I remember Mrs. Perkins made so much ado at her last ball, and whom old Perkins conducted to supper. When Sir Thomas Kickleberry died, he was one of the first tenants of the square. Who does not remember the scutcheon with the coronet with two balls, that flamed over number 36? Her son was at Eton then, and has subsequently taken an honorary degree at Oxford, and been an ornament of Platt's and the Swestry Club. He fled into St. James from the great house in Pocklington Square, and from St. James to Italy and the Mediterranean, where he has been for some time in a wholesome exile. Her eldest daughter's marriage with Lord Roughhead was talked about last year, But Lord Roughhead, it is known, married Miss Brent, and Horace Millican, very much to his surprise, found himself the affianced husband of Miss Lavinia Kickleberry, after an agitating evening at Lady Polkemore's, when Miss Lavinia, feeling herself faint, went out onto the leads, the terrace, Lady Polkemore will call it, on the arm of Mr. Millican. They were married in January. It's not a bad match for Miss K. Lady Kickleberry goes, and stops for 6 months of the year at Piggy Onkit with her daughter and son-in-law, and now that they are come abroad, she comes to. She must be with Lavinia, under the present circumstances. When I am arm in arm, I tell this story glibly off to Langan, who is astonished at my knowledge of the world, and says, why, Titmarsh, you know everything. I do know a few things, Langan my boy, is my answer. Man don't live in society, and pretty good society, let me tell you, for nothing. The fact is, that all the above details, are known to almost any man in our neighborhood. Lady Kickleberry does not meet with you as much, and has greater folks than we can pretend to be at her parties. But we know about them. She'll condescend to come to Perkins, with whose firm she banks, and she may overdraw her account. But of that, of course, I know nothing. When Langan and I go downstairs to breakfast, we find, if not the best, at least the most conspicuous places in occupation of Lady Kickleberry's party, and the hulking London footman making a darkness in the cabin, as he stoops through it bearing cups and plates to his employers. Why do they always put mud into coffee on board steamers? Why does the tea generally taste of boiled boots? Why is the milk scarce and thin? And why do they have those bleeding legs of boiled mutton for dinner? I ask why? In the steamers of other nations you are well fed. Is it impossible that Britannia, who confessedly rules the waves, should attend to the victuals a little, and that meat should be well cooked under a Union Jack? I just put in this question, this most interesting question, in a momentous parenthesis, and resume the tale. When Langan and I descend to the cabin, then, the tables are full of gobbling people, and, though there do seem to be a couple of places near Lady Kickleberry, immediately she sees our eyes directed to the inviting gap, she slides out, and with her ample robe covers even more than that large space to which by art and nature she is entitled, and calling out, Horace, Horace! And nodding, and winking, and pointing, she causes her son-in-law to extend the wing on his side. We are cut of that chance of a breakfast. We shall have the tea at its third water, and those two damn black mutton chops, which nobody else will take, will fall to our cold share. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.